As you know, we began the interviews, the personal interviews today, and so the purpose of this presentation is to essentially reflect back on some of the major issues, the major trends, the major currents that have been going on through the sittings, for those who have been reported this morning, as a way of reflecting back on common issues, common questions that we might all be facing in our own practice. And I have to say it was a rich bounty of insights and commentary, varying experiences that I was able to, that I was grateful to be able to receive today and hopefully reflect back to you in a way that can be helpful to you in your practice. Before I begin, I'd like to recite the prayer of forgiveness, if you will, allow me. If by word, speech, or deed, I may do anything to harm or offend anyone, please forgive me, honored ones, who are in wisdom and compassion strong. I freely forgive anyone who may have offended me. I freely forgive myself. Well, let me begin by saying I think the fundamental sort of rule that we set down in terms of sort of asking those who sign up to have at least 2 days of solid practice before coming into the interview was sound. It was good because there was a very, very clear pattern of strong improvement from the first day to the second day. It is a cumulative process, and there is a process of momentum that's generated, you know, as we sit. So the longer we sit, the more momentum we're able to generate. And this was reflected in a number of activities. Most people, reported the better ability to be aware of their breaths, their breathing, the sensation of their breath. More people were able to find more consistency and rhythm in their walking meditation. A better ability to be aware of thoughts. In the beginning, for many people, it was just a big jumble of, discursive thinking. But over time, as you continually note thoughts, your ability to perceive thoughts, individual thoughts, or general sort of thought processes begins to deepen and begins to sharpen. So there was a clear improvement in people's abilities to recognize thoughts and what I call thinking patterns, how our thought processes get hooked into certain patterns of thinking. That's very, very important because that has to do with habits of thinking. So that can be a very powerful insight in terms of seeing how we tend to think in certain ways. There were a number of really powerful high points. A number of people attained very strong moments of insight and clear seeing, samadhi, momentary samadhi or deeper levels of samadhi. And it was reported in terms of seeing colors, seeing vibrating colors, patterns of colors, one case, a remarkable case, was seeing, observing pain, a localized pain in the neck, but just being able to observe it very closely, seeing it sort of transform into a sort of swirling pattern of energy that gradually sort of spread and became very pleasant. So what was began as unpleasant when investigated and observed very closely in terms of its movement, its energy, and how it changes over time, gradually shifted into a whole different sort of pattern and sensation that became actually pleasant. So this is almost a prima facie kind of evidence of if you begin to become sensitive to sensations, regardless of where they may come. They may come from itching or tingling or sensations in the body. It may even come from pain or irritating. If you remove the content of the sensation, I mean, you look beyond the content in terms of pleasant or unpleasant or painful, and just begin to reside in the energy of the sensation, moving with the energy of the sensation, you start to see its impermanence. You start to see its constantly transforming, shifting, changing quality. And if you stay with it, it can actually transmute into something entirely different. We spoke about an itch or even a mosquito bite, you know, turning into full-blown rapture and bliss. And that can actually happen if you sort of separate the content of the sensation in terms of what it is that you're reacting from, and just sort of coming down to the energy of the sensation itself, that can transform into something totally, totally different. So, you know, this was a wonderful sort of confirmation, you know, of this process. One person experienced this moment of time and space. I think it was more space, a certain elasticity of space. As if space kind of expanded and contracted for a moment. There was this sense of reality shifting, you know, visually and sort of temporally. It's almost like seeing a kind of time warp. And that was fascinating. It was one of the first times when I've heard of that sort of kind of seeing, that kind of vision. Another person spoke about seeing reality through a kind of diamond-like quality. Everything was being sort of had this crystalline clarity, and there was a sort of a pulsating sense of this reality. And this is a very clear, almost to the point of metaphorically clear, I mean, in the sense of crystalline, diamond-like. You know, so that's it's an indication of very clear, clear seeing, where it just reality has this luminescent, sort of transcendental quality about it. And it does happen when you come into deeper stages of concentration. So this is a very powerful insights. And you know, I think we've been generating in the last few days. One person mentioned an insight into childhood experiences as a way of understanding, you know, certain things that were happening, you know, in the present day, how it went back. It evoked memories of childhood, you know, conditioning, how certain experiences in childhood actually began to condition her response to certain things that were going on in the present day. And that's another wonderful sort of insight, how you see how you respond to situations as a result of experiences you might have had when you were a child. So these are exactly the kinds of insights, the kinds of understanding that starts to get generated when the mind becomes very clear and you have this clear sense of apprehension, perception, into the depths of your experience, in your subconscious and unconscious mind. And one person made a comment about having this moment of epiphany, and as soon as, you know, as soon as she started thinking about it, it disappeared. You know, it was like all of a sudden it was gone. And I recall that a person, I believe, in one of our earlier sessions had a similar question about coming into a state of samadhi, and as soon as he noticed he was in samadhi, it was gone. And actually, to me, that's a sort of confirmation of the basic premise of mindfulness, that when you're experiencing a mind state, whether it's a pleasant mind state or an unpleasant mind state, you know, it could be an emotion, an afflictive emotion, as soon as you notice that emotion disappears. And that's a common contention in MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction. That's how we use mindfulness to work with our afflictive emotions and sort of emotional regulation. And the explanation is, when you are experiencing something, your psychic energy, you know, is in the process of experiencing. I mean, you're engrossed in that particular experience, whether it's a negative or positive experience. But as soon as you start thinking about your experience, you know, commenting, judging, reacting, comparing, just thinking about, oh, wow, this is a really cool experience I'm having, or, you know, this is anger, 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 you're placing yourself in another energetic mental state, right? Because you're thinking about the experience that you were experiencing. You're no longer experiencing that experience, you're thinking about it. So as soon as you think about it, the energy of that experience disappears because it's no longer there. Now, if the experience is very powerful, it might come back, particularly if it's anger or rage or something like that. It will just come back because it's so powerful. Your mind is caught up in this holocaust of rage or something. But if those moments of mindfulness are very strong, they keep cutting into the energy, you know, of the emotion itself. So as you do this more and more, the energy of that emotion begins to attenuate, it begins to weaken, and this is how it begins to gradually diminish and fade away. This is exactly how it works. And it also works in the opposite direction. If you're experiencing a moment of samadhi, a visualization of something that's arising, a vision arising in the mind, and then you stop to say, wow, that's really cool, you know, I'm in samadhi, boom, it's gone. Right? So the trick here is to understand this in terms of two levels of perception. Two levels of perception. And I call this, one is clear perception, or the perception of innate awareness, if you might call it. You know, and the Pali term is citta. It's just momentary consciousness. It's just pure consciousness. And then there's another level, which I would call discursive awareness or cognitive awareness, where you're aware of something through the mind, through your thoughts. So if you're experiencing something purely and innately as a purely experiential process, you know, pure awareness is not cognitive in the sense that there's no discursive thinking involved. It's just pure awareness, right? You see something, you see a light, you hear a sound, you taste a taste, you know, it's just conscious awareness. It's just pure, undifferentiated awareness. It doesn't require any thought, it doesn't require any commentary, it doesn't require any description, it's simple awareness. Now, in all of the Buddhist traditions, this is called innate awareness. It's just clear consciousness. It's your consciousness, your ability to smell a smell or hear a sound or see a sight. It doesn't require any kind of commentary or description or anything. But then there is this other level, this what we call cognitive awareness, which is the awareness that comes through our ability to process our experience through our thoughts. So these are the two different levels of awareness. Now, if we can stay in that level of clear consciousness, then whatever that samadhi state, or you know, even anger, or afflictive emotions, which are basically thought-based, thought-fed emotions, begin to disappear because you're undercutting the discursive element of our cognitive, of our cognition process. That you're basically taking away that discursive element in terms of our thinking about our experience. So it's this ability to stay in that. So that's why, people who cultivate samadhi, who are able to take that samadhi deeper and deeper and deeper, have this ability to stay with it at the level of pure awareness rather than at the level of what we call discursive cognition. So the discursive cognition is what destroys the experience. So it's this ability to just stay with it, with a sense of pure, clear awareness. And this is the sort of goal to which we all aspire in our meditative practice. This is mindfulness. This is pure mindfulness. It's absent commentary, reactions, judgments, comparisons, any kind of discursive thinking. This pure, open awareness, complete, transparent awareness. So this is what we aspire to in the practice. Now, there are a number of issues that arose that are really common to the practice. And I want to sort of hit it, just kind of go down one by one. And the first is the issue of the incessant thinking mind. Planning, thinking, just constantly, you just can't turn it off. It just keeps going. Now, this is a real problem. And, I think the first 2 or 3 years of my practice was just sitting with my monkey mind. I mean, it's the monkey mind. It just won't let you go. And ironically, oftentimes it's people who are the most intelligent, the most articulate, the most, educated, who have the most difficulty with this because their minds are so incessant, it just keeps pounding away and you just can't get away from it. So there are a number of ways, I think, sort of techniques that you can use, and most of these I've sort of mentioned before. Use of mental exercises like rhythmic breathing. Both rhythmic breathing in terms of counting the breath or the timing, breathing with a certain kind of cadence. There are two kinds of rhythms, right? So the most simple is just counting the breath. So the most simple would be just one in-breath, one out-breath as one. One in-breath, one out-breath as two. So count up to, in the beginning you start with a low number like 3 or 4. So you count up to 4, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, or you go to 4, 3, 2, 1, 4, 3, 2, 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 4, 3, 2, 1, sort of counting up and counting down, counting up and counting down. And you'd be surprised how difficult it is even to get to the 4 because your mind is so distracted. So this is a really very good fundamental sort of technique to use. Then, of course, the other is the rhythmic breathing, where you're actually breathing in and breathing out according to a certain cadence, like a 4 count, like breathing in, 2, 3, 4, breathing out, 2, 3, 4, breathing in, 2, 3, 4, etc. And you can also, obviously, you can change the cadence. You can go up to 5 or 6 or 3, use a number that works for you in terms of, the natural rhythm of your own breath. And this is also wonderful for oxygenating your brain, because with that kind of rhythmic breathing, it tends to oxygenate your system, and especially if you're feeling sleepy or, you know, kind of sloth and torpor, it brings up the energy level, you know, in the mind as you breathe. Now, the other one is one that I recommend. Well, I do all of these in my own practice because, you know, I have the same problems as anybody else does. And that is using metta or compassion meditation. And the thing about metta and compassion is that it's basically a concentration practice, because what you're doing is you're constantly repeating a mantra, you know, may you be well, happy and peaceful, or may I be well, happy and peaceful, or may you be free from suffering and the causes of suffering, may I be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. And you're visualizing yourself, or you're visualizing a person. So this is not mindfulness practice, it's different, it's a concentration practice, but it's very good because it gets you into a certain rhythm, and it, you know, in the same thing as the rhythmic breathing, it tends to oxygenate your system, and it focuses your concentration either through the visualization or the recitation of the mantra. You know, may I be well, happy, and peaceful, etc., etc. So these are devices that you can use to, you know, sort of come to terms with the, you know, incessant thinking mind, the mind that's constantly, training away. One interesting comment that came up, and that was about boredom, feeling bored, particularly in the walking meditation. You know, I was walking along and someone went bored, so this is not working for me, so I shift to another place. I walk along, that's how it works, so I shift to another place. And as the person was saying that, the word boredom kind of hit me. And I said, well, what do you mean boredom? I mean, how can you feel bored? I mean, what is it that makes you feel bored? I mean, you know, you don't like something, right? It's boring. Actually, boredom is a form of greed. Boredom is a form of suffering, in the sense of not getting what we want. Right? We get bored because we're not getting what we expected. I'm bored. This is not what I want. When you come down to it, a lot of afflictive emotions, boredom, anger, disappointment, envy, jealousy, it's about not getting what we want. It's about unfulfilled expectations, right? You know, we expect something, and we're not getting it. So we get angry, we get disappointed, we get bored, right? So suffering, and if you think about it, suffering itself is about not getting what we want. It's all about desire. This is the second noble truth, right? It's all about desire. Craving, clinging. And afflictive emotions are just the other side. It's the emotional reaction about not getting what we want. So either we're caught up in clinging, craving, and desire, and wanting and desire, or we're caught up in anger, frustration, you know, and boredom because we're not getting what we want. So it's all about getting what we want. This is a second noble truth. So this is really coming down to clinging, desire, the second noble truth. So, what I was saying, and I think what's important, and this goes back to the fundamental teaching, when we encounter boredom or unpleasant feelings, instead of simply doing something else, you know, which is a diversionary kind of activity, right? Open to the boredom. Open to that unpleasant feeling. What is it that you're expecting that you're not getting? Ask yourself, what is it that I don't like about this? What's unpleasant? Allow yourself to just open to that question. So try to understand why we don't like it. What is it that I'm not getting, that I'm reacting to, that I'm feeling this sense of aversion? Boredom is this mild kind of aversion. So what is it that we're wanting that we're not getting? And 9 out of 10 times, if you're able to answer that question, it's like, oh, is that all it was? And all of a sudden, poof, it's gone. It just disappears. But it's only there because we don't ask that question. We don't inquire what it is that I'm wanting that I'm not getting. And 9 out of 10 times, if you ask it, it's really, really simple. You know, I just want to be more comfortable, or I want something that's tastier or more comfortable, or makes me feel better. It all comes down to very, very, very simple desires and how we crave them, and we get all angry if we don't get them. So basically it's quite simple, but the whole idea is to just take that moment whenever you're feeling that sandpaper of aversion or boredom or fear or, you know, disappointment. Just look at it, feel it, and try to understand what it is, why you're feeling that way. Another issue was noting. Several comments came up about noting. And the issue of how we note things. And of course, the whole idea of noting is as a device, a simple device to disidentify, you know, with what's happening, particularly if it's an emotion like anger, disappointment, grief, or sadness. We just name it. As we name it, that process of naming puts that experience into the discursive mode. You know, we talk about discursive cognitive mode, right? So it works two ways. We can use that cognitive discursive mode as a way of identifying and moving away from things that we're caught up in. You know, as opposed to if you're in samadhi, you want to go to, you know, sort of clear comprehension to stay in that samadhi and move away from discursive, you know, discursive awareness or discursive cognitive awareness. But in the case when you're caught in something like a negative emotion, you use the discursive awareness to get out of it and see it clearly. So these are devices that work both ways. Now the question, there are several questions, like when I note things that are going on, should I use the word articulate, you know, clearly articulate what I'm feeling and use a word to denote that? Or can I do it at a more intuitive level, sort of a feeling level? You know, so this is, you know, this is non-productive, it's not helping, and, you know, I vaguely sense it's a distracting thing or feeling or sensation. And just move away from it and back to your object, and back to the breath. Both ways work. You don't, I think the literal sort of articulation of the note is a device that we use. Sometimes when we're working with situations that are very ambiguous, we don't know quite how we feel, or we're feeling sort of this away and that away about something, and so we use words to sort of characterize what's arising in the mind and body, particularly if it's a kind of sensation. But then there are times when it's fairly clear what's arising, and we just simply note it kind of mentally and just move back to the object. So it depends. I think as you develop more practice and experience, you know, in the meditative practice, you know, it becomes more naturally, you know, you see things arising and you're just able to sort of move away from them and just come back to the breath with minimum of effort. So it becomes much easier. You don't have to go through the literal process of formulating a word in your mind to, you know, to denote what's going on. Another comment that came up, which was very interesting, was seeing the breath, actually be able to feel the breath. You know, some people have breathing issues. You know, I've worked with people who have lung problems, so just breathing, you know, is a problem. And so how do you work with the breath, you know, in that way? Well, there are a number of ways to do this. I mean, obviously, the first is, you know, just take a few deep breaths, you know, just feel the breath as much as you can. The air, the flow of the air as it moves through the body, especially the body expands as you release the air. And try to just sense the feeling of the breath. Just sense the feeling of the breath. And then you can use some of the tools that we spoke before, you know, rhythmic breathing or counting your breath or the rising and falling of the abdomen, because this is a sort of a substitute. I mean, we know usually when we breathe inward, the abdomen rises. When we breathe outward, the abdomen falls. So we use that. For example, I belt, you know, the sensation of my belt around my waist is a sensation that I use as a marker for rising and falling. So there are different ways to track your breath, as it were. Even if you might have trouble, you know, with the physical act of breathing. And this is something that, a sensitivity that I think we develop over time. I think one of the things that you begin to notice is when you come into deeper states of concentration and samadhi, how refined the breath is. I mean, to the point where it doesn't seem like you're breathing at all. The breath is so shallow and so, you know, so refined that there's barely any air going in and out. And, you know, your whole metabolic system is at almost a kind of equilibrium. You know, everything is just at this one sort of level of equilibrium. This is minimum amount of air coming in, minimum amount of air coming out. And then, of course, if you're highly agitated emotionally, you know, your breathing is different. It's jerky. It's, you know, it's not smooth. It doesn't flow. So it's a really powerful indicator of, you know, your emotional state. Just as we talk about sensations being an indicator of our emotional states, our breath is also a strong indicator of our emotional state. Another comment that came up was sleepiness. I mean, real sleepiness. I mean, hardly can stay awake kind of sleepiness. And so, obviously, you know, this is one of the hindrances, you know, in terms of sloth and torpor. You know, there's sloth and torpor, there's restlessness and agitation, which is just the opposite. And then there's desire, craving, wanting, you know, getting caught up in desires and wants, or aversion and ill will, you know, sort of negative emotions, getting caught up in negative emotions. So the standard, you know, sort of instructions, sort of noting and sort of, you know, letting go. But there's another aspect to these hindrances which are important to sort of understand. It is that when you fall into certain patterns of thinking, in terms of the hindrances, these might be actually habitual patterns of thinking that characterize your personality. You know, are you the greed type? You're always wanting, desiring things, or are you the aversive type? Or do you have a mind that's constantly restless and agitated and jumping all over the place and, you know, kind of never being able to settle on things? Or do you have a mind that's sleepy and dull? I mean, you know, we had a whole conversation about what a dull mind is, right? What is a dull mind? Now, the insight here is that these may, in fact, be patterns of behavior that, if we're not careful, can actually be shields or diversionary emotional responses to opening to unpleasant feelings and sensations. I mean, in other words, there are kinds of escapes. There are forms of escape from facing the truth of what's coming up in our experience. So we fall prey to these kinds of patterns of thinking. So he's an angry type. He's always angry. He's running around. He's having angry thoughts and agitated. Or this person is really kind of dull, sleepy. Never doesn't seem to be paying attention. But these are strategies. These can be unconscious strategies that we're actually employing so as not to face reality or see reality as it truly is, particularly if it's uncomfortable. So this is an area that can actually, and this is what suffering is, right? These are patterns of suffering. So it's very important to, particularly in this case, you know, we're talking about sleepiness, but this person who was reporting about sleepiness was also reporting about a childhood trauma that had occurred. And she had a glimmer of it in the walking meditation. And so I was thinking, you know, obviously you can't help but put the two together, right? I mean, so there's this childhood trauma that somehow she had a glimmer of it, but she's fighting through the sleepiness all the time. So how much of that sleepiness is real sleepiness, or how much of that sleepiness, you know, is a subconscious, you know, mechanism? So this is something that is important for us to pay attention to when we encounter these hindrances, you know, aversion, clinging, rejection, anger, sleepiness, and agitation. Sleepiness and agitation are, you know, classic responses, you know, to reality. We don't want to deal with it, so we get all agitated. We get all restless. We jump up and we leave the hall because I can't deal with this. And, you know, that's, in a way, that becomes a kind of delusion. You know, it's a way of hiding from a reality that we don't want to face. So this is something to be really cautious and really careful about. Yeah.
Are you saying then that sleepiness and agitation equally can be an avoidance technique?
They could be avoidance techniques, yeah.
And what do you do about it?
Well, become aware of it. Think about it. You know, use your, even in meditation or just in terms of reflection, you know, just reflecting back on it, particularly if there are things that seem to be down there, you know, like this person was speaking about a childhood trauma that needs to be, you know, understood. And if there's a pattern of behavior that somehow seemingly unconnectedly seems to be, you know, hindering our capacity for clarity, maybe they may not be unconnected. Maybe there might be a connection. So it's having this sense of intelligence and curiosity to put these two things together. You have to be like a kind of Sherlock Holmes. I mean, this is about figuring out what's going on inside our minds. So this is where the mindfulness, you know, can be a really powerful tool. And the understanding, you know, of these hindrances. There's a very famous Tibetan nun, Aliom, Sutram Aliom. And she has a book called Feeding Your Demons.
I have it.
Oh, okay. So make friends with your demons. Just make friends with your demons.
You know. I think I'm going to open it.
Okay, yeah. Have a look at it. I mean, it's a really powerful book, and I think it really works. Yeah. I mean, it's like, okay, I know you're there, so, all right. Give me a break, okay? I'll just go away for about, 5 minutes so I can meditate.
I know you're there.
You know, look, I'll pay attention to you at 6 o'clock when I get home, you know, we'll talk, okay?
Yeah.
So, not now, mind, you know. So,
okay.
All right. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's good.
A quick question about noting.
Yeah.
Can you share, like, how many concurrent notings do you do you do at the school?
Actually, you know, Upandita was a very famous Burmese sadhana. And I'm trying to remember when you asked that question. I did a retreat with him once. And he actually said, how many times do you note in a minute? How many times do you note in a minute? So can you count how many times? And literally, so it came down to a numerical count. How many times do you note things arising? And it could be hundreds of times in the space of a sitting. But the important thing is to know that that's what you're doing. Not just getting caught up in a kind of miasmic, you know, we often just fall into a kind of hypnagogic state. Just kind of, everything's just going here and out, or that hypnagogic state. And noting, hypnagogic state, noting. So actually, you're actually counting each act of noting, which is a really powerful exercise. So, so it's the amount of times you actually catch a thought arising, catch your mind state, and see the mind state that you're in. That could be 1 second. But the point is you want to come back to your breath. So the breath is the primary object. So you note something, you let it go, and you come back to the breath. Now, if you're in mindfulness, when you're opening up to things as they're arising in your awareness, that's a little bit different. You stay with it for as long as it's there. The energy of that experience is there. And then when it fades, you let it go. So the noting is more... Well, you can use the noting in mindfulness too, but I think there's more of a, what they call choiceless awareness. There's a more expansive acceptance of what's arising. In concentration, you're noting just to basically clear the mind. So it's a different kind of a process a little bit. Another comment was the noting of pain or the noting of unpleasant sensations. And it had to do with, if I'm feeling pain, to what extent do I just bear the pain and note it and, refrain from moving, or adjusting my position? And, what's the limit, in terms of how far I can go with this? And essentially, I hope I paraphrase that correctly, but the idea in this practice, it's not about no pain, no gain. I mean, it's not like bearing the pain in spite of the intolerable pain that you're feeling. But it's about being aware of what's happening in the moment, right? So I'm noticing the pain, and I'm saying, this is really too much. I can't take it anymore. So suffering, then desire to move, then gradually lifting, moving, touching, leaning, shifting, lifting, adjusting. In other words, whatever we do, it's about being aware of what we do, then bearing any kind of afflicted pain or afflictive emotion. It's the awareness of what we do. So it's not, so we're not trying to fulfill some standard of doing something correct or doing something wrong. It's not about correct or wrong or doing something right or wrong. It's being aware of what we do. So it's this whole idea of understanding the perfection of things. I mean, it's not about what we do, but being clear about what it is and what the moral implications in terms of skillfulness or unskillfulness of that is. So if I'm at the point where I can't stand my pain and I have to adjust my position in order to relieve the pain, that's okay. As long as you're aware that you're doing it, and I'm not just doing it unconsciously, without even thinking, because I'm agitated and I'm just, pissed off that my knees are killing me, and I just move my leg without thinking. That's an unconscious move. That's a reactive move. said, so we don't want to fall prey to unconscious reactivity. That's the whole point. And that's that conditioning that says, you know, I want to be comfortable and I'm not comfortable and my leg is killing me, so I'm angry and because my expectations are not being met, and so I just react, you know, according to conditions. And then this whole episode goes by and I don't even know that that one little episode could have been a moment of awakening. So I've foregone on the whole preciousness of that moment because of my ignorance. I didn't realize that it was potentially a moment of mindfulness. It was a moment of awakening. So it's bringing this awareness to all our actions and, you know, sort of seeing what we're doing. And if we're seeing that we're in a state of suffering, then accepting that suffering is there, you know, my leg hurts because, you know, my leg is in a certain position and my knee is like this and my ligaments and tendons are like that. I'm not an athlete or, you know, a runner or something like that. You know, I've got aching knees. It's okay. That's my karma. So just accept it. So just do what I need to work with it where it is. The same thing with emotional pain. It's like, that's what it is. You just work with it where it is. And it's there for a reason. Just accept it and be okay with it and move on. I mean, this is the whole idea of just working with what we have, accepting what we have, and working with what we have. So that eliminates the suffering, the anguish over the pain in my knee, or my emotional pain, or whatever, you know, I might be suffering from. Now, the last sort of comment I wanted to make was this whole thing about sensations. How important, you know, it is to really understand sensations, you know, as the gateway, as a very powerful gateway to understanding. And this goes down to, you know, we talk about the walking meditation in terms of opening to sensations, you know, predominant sensations like our feet pressing against the floor, feeling the carpet between our toes, and it goes all the way up to feeling the tingling in my spine that leads up into my cranium that leads to full-blown rapture and bliss and jhana. You know, that comes from the mosquito bite that I got on my cheek. Or feeling the emotions of my anger, of my grief, or my sadness, or my envy or my jealousy. What does sadness feel like in the body? There's a feeling. There's a hollowness, a emptiness in the stomach, a tightness in the chest. You know, my hair is standing up on the nape of my neck. My hands are sweaty. I feel the heart here on my arms are standing up. And I feel a chill down my back. These are hallmarks. These are feelings that when we develop this kind of sensitivity to, open the doorway to awareness. So it's really, really important. In the teaching, this, you know, it's called Vedana Nupassana. Vedana Nupassana. Awareness or insight into feelings. Vedana Nupassana. Feelings as a doorway to insight. You know, there are basically three gateways. There's the body, Kaya Nupassana. There are feelings, which is Veda Nupassana. And there's the mind, which is Chitta Nupassana. So these are the three gateways to understanding. So very powerful. So it's not the only gateway. There are three of them. But Kaya, the body, and Vedana, feelings, are really strong ones. I mean, because they're visceral, right? They're visceral. We feel it in the body. They're pleasant, they're unpleasant, they're painful, they're whatever. So just opening to those feelings, they literally become the gateway to understanding. They become the gateway, actually, to citta, to thoughts and emotions. So all of this is, you know, embedded in our physical body, right? Our vagus nerve that runs from our spine all the way up to our brain. That's the main sort of concourse through which feelings become thoughts, emotions, feelings and sensations become thoughts and emotions. And that's why when we talk about opening the sense doors, sight, smell, taste, touch, feelings, everything. And it's in that opening that we start to see the inherent beauty of things. So the bonus is this aesthetic pleasure that we get in just seeing the beauty of everything, the beauty of life. And we got into a little discussion of wabi-sabi, the concept of wabi-sabi. You know, if you don't know about it, please look it up, because wabi-sabi is exactly this idea of this whole aesthetic of beauty, of seeing things when you're in a state of samadhi. You have to be in a state of samadhi to see the inherent beauty of all things. So it becomes an aesthetic. It becomes an expression of sublime beauty. And that's why, you know, the great golden ages of Buddhism in China and Korea and Japan were ages of great art, right? Great culture. Because, you know, when you're in that state of open-hearted acceptance of reality, you can't but help but see the beauty in all things. And this is where joy, gratitude comes from. When you see the beauty of all things, you can't help but be filled with joy and gratitude. So gratitude becomes the foundation that allows us to move into the world with love and compassion and service to the community. This is what a bodhisattva is made out of, that gratitude. And it's that gratitude that reflects back on the community. You know, we spoke about bodhisattvas a little bit. But it comes from that fullness of heart that sees the beauty and the richness of life, because a mind and a heart that's completely open, a mind and a heart that completely sees and perceives reality as it truly is. Okay, so thank you all.